Good afternoon. Welcome to Microsoft Tech Air 2012. Let's hear it. Good noise. Welcome. My name is Jesse Mulligan. I'm a comedian. I'm your MC for the afternoon. Some of you may know me from 7 Days, TV3's number one rating show. Some of you may know me from What I Lie to You, TV3's number 214 rating show. There are 1,500 people in this room. According to our latest ratings, 11 of you have seen that show. Hands up who it is. One, two. Really? Is that it? Oh, my God. Hello, it's good. You could put your hand with your wristband up as well. Has everyone got their wristband? Hold on to it. It's your entry to Tech Fest, your blue wristband, and it's quite technologically as well. Basically, what happens when you enter a session here at Tech Ed, it clocks in, and if you set it up with your Facebook, everyone who knows you can see where you are. So if you are here today and you work for one of Microsoft's competitors, bad news. We have a cool afternoon in front of us. Look at this room. Look at these massive TV screens. Have you worked it out yet? This isn't Tech Ed at all. It's the world premiere of Keeping Up with the Ridges, TV3's new reality show starring Sally and Jamie Ridge. It's the only way we could be sure that you would watch. No, I don't know what these big screens are for. We'll find out. Maybe it's the first full body Skype call with Kim.com. I don't know. And I'm already excited. I'm from Hamilton, a very technological city. Thank you. A recent survey showed that 30% of Hamiltonians had or know someone who has a cell phone. We're early adopters. No. I tease Hamilton a lot. Hamilton actually is quite technological. And I'll tell you a bit more about that later on this afternoon. But I like Hamilton. It's quirky. I don't live there anymore, but every time I go back, I see something that reminds me of what makes Hamilton, Hamilton. Last time I went back, I went out for a game of golf with my dad, went on to the first tee of Lochiel Golf Course in Hamilton, and on the first tee, the greenskeeper had put a sign up, and the sign said, "Warning, fungicide in use. Do not lick hands or balls." And I thought, I'm back. Don't see signs like that in Auckland. But yeah, Hamilton was the birthplace of it all. I'll tell you all about it later, but right now I'd like to get this keynote underway. We've got so many interesting people to hear from today, and the first one is from Microsoft. I'd ask you to put your hands together and make a bit of noise, please, for the Director of Developer and Platform Evangelism. Please welcome Scott Wiley.
Cheers. Hey, thank you, Jesse. So my name's Scott, and I'm a geek. And you may think of me as the head geek of Microsoft New Zealand, because I run the Development Platform Group. And we get to do all sorts of cool things, as, evangelizing new technology to technical audiences. And we get to do a few things like running this whole event, you know, Tech Ed. It's a pretty responsible job overall. But it hasn't always been this way. So back in the 80s when I was a struggling musician, my day job was a computer programmer, mainframe programmer. And I first came across PCs and some software from this brash little startup called Microsoft back in the 80s. And you know what? I loved it. I was hooked. And I thought it was something really cool, and it was something that I wanted to do base my career around. And as an old school rocker, I can kind of relate to this guy. So we ran a competition to see who should come to Tech Ed, get a free ticket to come to Tech Ed. And Baron, you did an amazing job. Are you here? Yeah. Yeah, fantastic commitment. We love you, man. Thank you. On a slightly more serious note about commitment, just a call out to some of the folks in the room. So we'd like to acknowledge that it's 2 years today since the first earthquake in Christchurch. And just a call out to 150 or so people from Christchurch in the room. Kia kaha, we're with you, and we're thinking about you. Okay, so 1996. I joined Microsoft in 1996. It was kind of the golden era of Microsoft. Think about Windows NT, think about establishing credibility in the enterprise and all these sorts of things. It was a pretty special time, but you know what? You know, there's nothing that's going to match what we're doing this year. So, for 5 years or so, I've been coming up here and welcoming you to Tech Ed and making some announcements from time to time, things like Windows 7, Windows Azure, some of the things that stand out for me. But you know, this year is something, really something special. This is the biggest year in our history. So the biggest year in Microsoft history, the most launches, the most new stuff that's going to be coming your way. And it's the culmination of a very deliberate strategy that you're going to see a whole lot of stuff off this afternoon, then over the next 3 days. We're going to put the technology in your hands. It includes Windows 8, Server 2012, Office 2013, Visual Studio 2012, just a whole lot more, not to mention some incredibly innovative hardware coming from our hardware partners and from Microsoft ourselves. It's a very special time. So our industry is moving along at an enormous pace. Huge innovation, the rise and rise of social networks, the expectation for always-on connectivity, and the blurring between life and work, and the blurring between, you know, business and consumer. And we're going to talk about that a lot this afternoon. The speed of change is unprecedented. And I was reminded last week at the sad news of the passing of Neil Armstrong. Commentators made the statement that, hey, he walked on the moon a mere 66 years after the Wright brothers first, you know, took to the skies in some kind of controlled human flight. And I kind of put that, you know, in the context of our industry. So Alan Turing first, you know, dreamed up the Turing engine about 1936. Colossus, the first vaguely programmable computer, about 1946. You know, the invention of the microchip around 1959. We're kind of at that same time. So I think that we can, in our industry, that we're ready for the next giant leap. And Microsoft's ready for this. We're ready for a future which is, you know, touch-enabled, which is always on, which is driven by the cloud, and which is socially integrated. And it's going to be a fantastic new world. So over the next hour or so, we're going to give you a glimpse, as much as we can fit in over the next little while, of this incredible journey. And then we're going to take a step into something completely different, and something I know you're going to absolutely love, and that's taking the human context for data, and big data in particular, and how we can make best use of it. So it's an incredible time to be in tech. We're ready at Microsoft. I know you're going to leave after Friday fully equipped to take on all the new challenges, and hopefully more than a little inspired. So for our first speaker, I'd like to bring onto the stage from Microsoft New Zealand, Bradley Burrows.
Thanks, John. So, good evening, everyone. My name is Bradley Burrows. I'm 40 years of age, and I am a geek too. But I haven't always been this way. For a period of my life, I was one of those annoying skateboarders that went down Queen Street. But then I developed, and I became a professional skateboarder for a period of time. I got to skate with Tony Hawk as an extreme skateboarder for a period of years. But then, in 1985, my world changed. My friend Scott called me over to his house. And he said, I've got this amazing device sitting in my bedroom. Come and have a look. So I went in, and there was a computer in front of me. And he was playing this game called Dune. And I looked at it and went, wow. This was a 386 DX16, and it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen. But when Scott's mum left, we decided to take this thing apart and see how it worked. This thing had 4 megabytes of RAM sitting inside it. I was hooked. I wanted to know how all these things worked. But still, June had me. But what had I missed? What had taken me so long to get involved? Well, a few magical things had happened. In 1969, the microprocessor had been invented, and this changed everything. Then, in 1975, Bill Gates and Paul Allen came together, and they proclaimed software was the most important thing. But it wasn't until IBM and the software that Bill and Paul had developed pulled it together. Did they legitimize what was going on with the microprocessor? And in front of me, in pieces at the time, was this 386 DX16, which was their creation. But yet, it was still June that had me hooked. So Microsoft and Atari are re-releasing some classic Atari video games. This will come out on HTML5 platforms, and with IE10 on Windows 8 devices, you'll be able to use a touch-based interface to interact with the new Atari games. I highly recommend you have a go of these. They are absolutely stunning. But moving forward, 1995 rolled around, and things are about to get a whole lot better. I remember queuing up at the store to get my copy of Windows 95. I remember taking it home, unraveling it, and installing it off the 46 floppy disks that were needed. 2 hours later, I started up this new world of computers. Now, it wasn't the new UI that got me hooked. It was something very different. What's with these homies dissing my girl? Why do they got a front? That is the original Weezer video from Windows 95. How many people remember playing that for the very first time? Yeah? It's an amazing experience. You think that was probably the first music video ever played on a computer at that point in time. And my eyes opened, realizing that what we had in front of us was not just a gaming machine, but a multimedia-rich platform that we could use and enjoy and be creative with. I was really, really hooked. But also 1995 was another sort of big change for me personally. Something else happened in my life. How many people remember that lovely sound? The internet. Then the internet came along and it enabled us all to be pioneers of what we do now. And some of us in the industry took this and answered this call and moved forward with it. Then if we progress to 2003, there's another massive change. Laptops, for the first time, outsold desktop computers. We were entering a new era of computing. Mobile computing had hit us. And then, 2007, we entered the true digital native. They had arrived. They used devices that they can touch, speak with, interact with. And when did phones become more expensive than computers? When they became easier to use. Now, I'd like to take the time and the privilege to invite Paul Thurrott up on the stage. You may know him from such great podcasts as Windows Weekly and What the Tech, and he's recently released a key book called Windows 8 Secrets, and of course the famous Delphi 3 Super Bible.
I'm never going to leave the Delphi Super Bible behind, I guess. I just wanted to start off by saying thank you to all of you, to Microsoft especially, for letting me come to New Zealand to take part in TechEd. I'm honored to do so. Obviously, I come from the other side of the planet. And I was talking to my kids about this trip. They're very jealous about it. They wanted to know what New Zealand was like. I really don't know what New Zealand is like. I have some vague ideas about New Zealand. I know you have a lot of extreme sports here, beautiful vistas. A couple of semi-famous movies have been made here. You have kind of a strange rivalry with Australia that I don't understand. But really, it was my friend John who turned me on to maybe the most important thing about Australia, about New Zealand, rather, sorry. Which is that it's not Australia. No, which is the All Blacks. My friend John lived in Australia for several years, and he loves New Zealand, respects New Zealand, and he said, if you need to know one thing about this place, it is this, and he turned me on to the haka, or he tried to. I can't really say that I understand it. I would like someone here to explain it to me, not right now, but sometime in the future. Awesome, awesome stuff. So obviously, anytime geeks get together like this, the story inevitably turns to, well, what was your first computer? And everybody thinks they have the most awesome first computer, you know, that awful, you know, piece of junk, whatever it was, back in the 1970s or the 1980s. But I can assure you, I have the worst first computer of all time, and that is this. If you don't recognize this, this is the computer add-on for the Intellivision video game system. It had a 159 by 192 pixel display, roughly the size of an icon today in a modern computer, 16 colors, 8 sprites, 2K of RAM, 2K of RAM. But it had the basic programming language, and you could save your basic programs on cassette tape. So I went to Radio Shack, bought a cassette tape, learned how to program, sort of, using sort of a computer. And from this moment on, I was hooked, as sad and pathetic as this is. Wasn't originally a Microsoft fan. As the 1980s progressed, the IBM PC came out, obviously had MS-DOS on it, also Microsoft's version of BASIC. Microsoft supplied the version of BASIC that was on the Commodore computers of the day, which I was actually a fan of and a user of for many, many years. Wasn't so impressed by the PC. As I moved forward to the Amiga, Microsoft released Windows 3.0. So I went to the local dealer, got a copy, brought it home, installed it on my wife's computer, which was a PS1 computer, 14 megahertz, 286, not so great even for the day. It was so slow that you could watch the menus draw in real time. And they would literally draw like this, and the words would fill in. And I just sort of laughed, and I said, this thing will never, ever catch on. Never. So thus, my career as a pundit was born on that day. I've never been right ever since. But a couple of things happened over time that turned me around, both to Microsoft specifically, but also to the PC in general. The first were these awesome, awesome games of the day. They're actually still fun to play now, right? The thing that's interesting about these games to me is that I had an Amiga, and I was an Amiga snob, but the things that happened in these games, the technology in these games, were far above anything that was available on the Amiga of that day, and it was just eye-opening for me. The second thing was a series of releases from Microsoft, that company that I had previously disrespected. As a writer, the first one that really got me going was Word 6.0. My wife worked at a company that had early access to this application. I saw it, and I thought, this is amazing and professional and excellent, and we have nothing like it on the Amiga. And I started thinking about maybe moving over to the dark side, as I thought of it at the time. The second thing, though, was Windows for Workgroups 3.11. I needed this for a class. Amazing networking capabilities, the ability to connect two or more computers together, access resources on the different computers. It was just amazing to me. And then, of course, Windows 95, which I think we all understand. But what really put me over the top and what put me in the place that I am today, as sort of a major advocate for Microsoft platforms and a person who helps users of Microsoft platforms, was really Windows NT, and NT 5.0 specifically. You know it as Windows 2000, but in the days before it was released, it was originally called Windows NT 5.0. I started a website that had to be renamed about 7 times, first because Microsoft kept changing the name of the product, and then they wanted me to move the name Windows to the end, not from the front, and today it's called the Supersite for Windows. But it was really based around this notion of excitement and enthusiasm about a version of Windows that took all of the good stuff from Windows 9X and combined it with all of the good stuff from Windows NT, and ultimately resulted into a single product line based on that NT kernel. Intervening years have been kind of interesting, of course. A lot of ups, a lot of downs, but it's interesting to me that during this period, Microsoft really shot for the stars with a couple of interesting projects that never really turned into actual products, although the technologies from them, of course, continued in some ways. With Cairo, they had the notion of an object-oriented user interface. The long-run project, which became Windows Vista, had the notion of a relational database-backed file system. Ultimately, Microsoft came out recently, 3 years ago, with Windows 7, which is the most successful version of Windows ever. It sells over 20 million units every month. And the success of this product made me a little nervous because I thought this will be the path that Microsoft follows going forward, that they will take this mature product line, they'll kind of evolve it going forward. And the interesting thing is, this year, Microsoft is doing something that's bigger than both of those other projects combined. It is the biggest year in the history of Microsoft. That to you, sir.
We get to share now. So it's now not time to look ahead and to get an understanding of what a new era might look like. We are entering an amazing time in our industry where almost every day we see something new, amazing, entering our marketplace. And it's amazing to see New Zealand at the forefront of this, participating, contributing with amazing pieces of innovation. If you look at the Martin jetpack behind me, this is the inspiration, innovation, perspiration of 30 years of development work by Glenn Martin. And the team, Luke Reed and the team down in Dunedin, Aerograph, they take photorealism software photos and put them into virtual environments. We punch above our weight with strong R&D in the technology sector, but we are also contributing to the new age of touch-first applications. For us in New Zealand, boundaries have been removed. And we are now providing world-class applications that span across multiple platforms that are used around the world. For us at Microsoft, this will be our biggest year in our 37-year history. We see this as the start of our new era, because we will be reimagining almost our entire product line, everything from Windows Client, Windows Server, Office, Xbox, and to the phone.
I don't know if you've heard, but on October 26th, Microsoft is going to release Windows 8, which it describes as a complete reimagining of Windows. Normally, I would look at that as some form of hyperbole, but I have to say in this case, that's absolutely not an exaggeration.
Across all of these products, you will experience the new Windows UI, which will provide you a rich user experience with live tiles that traverse everything from the client to the phone to the Xbox. And as a consumer, this means that you will experience your experience of Windows moves with you and across all the devices that you own.
And if you're a developer or an IT pro, which I assume most of you are, this also means that you can reach your users with a more consistent and coherent set of user experiences that makes sense across the various devices that they use.
Now, behind any great actor is a great director. Windows Server 2012 brings this picture together. And I'm pleased to announce that tomorrow morning, in New Zealand, we will be the first country in the world to launch Windows Server 2012. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because I really want to save a lot of the content that's coming tomorrow. But I strongly encourage you to come along to the sessions. We're going to have an amazing time. We've got some fantastic giveaways that we've never, ever done at a Microsoft TechEd before. So if you can, get along to the Windows Server sessions. It's 2012, and you shouldn't need to compromise with what you do. You should have a single device that does it all, where your settings, your apps, your data goes with you. You should be able to plug in a camera, a USB drive, with your photos, music, and videos all accessible to it. You should be able to plug in a printer. And you should be able to switch accounts on the fly to give your kids a safe place to play. But you need a desktop. In my day-to-day life, I use applications that live on the desktop, but I can quickly and easily switch between the new world of touch-first applications to applications that run off the desktop. Now, we're very lucky to have some amazing devices behind me. We're going to have a quick look at some of those now.
Oh, I dreamed of this day that I would be on the other side. This machine is a Qualcomm Liquid reference design, reference platform. It's a Windows RT device. So if you understand what I do or if you care about technology at all, you understand how exciting this is for me, and that as soon as the lights go off, I'm going to grab this machine and run out of the room with it. I've been waiting over a year to get my hands on a Windows RT device. It is essentially, if you've not heard of Windows RT, it's essentially Windows 8 running on an ARM platform rather than on a standard x86 platform. These devices will typically be very thin and light, get excellent battery life, and so forth. The one thing that they lack is compatibility with third-party desktop applications. But what you see here on the desktop, or what you can see over my shoulder, I hope, is the Windows 8-style start screen with all of the touch and multi-touch features you would expect, all of the Windows 8-style apps. But you also do get the desktop. Find the desktop, including all the normal utilities. Everything that's built into into Windows 8 for the most part is available in Windows RT as well. File Explorer, Task Manager, and so forth. Windows RT happens to come with four of the all new Office applications, Word 2013, Excel, PowerPoint, and OneNote. They work exactly like and look exactly like their equivalents on the x86 versions of Windows 8. But if the desktop on Windows RT is too limiting, there are virtualization-based solutions for accessing Windows 8 desktop apps on this system as well. You can use Remote App to access applications like Adobe Photoshop, which you see here, or Visual Studio. Or you can use a full VDI environment. This desktop that you're looking at here is Windows 8. It's running a CAD/CAM program that runs on Windows 8 that is not available for Windows RT, but you can run it through a remote desktop connection. You can run video full screen over this connection, and it works exactly as you would expect. You'll be able to access it in this fashion. Now, of course, Windows RT is not the only solution for portable computing going forward. Microsoft's partners also have a host of these x86-based devices, Windows PCs, that look and work much like the Windows RT-type devices. This one is particularly amazing-looking, very thin Acer device.
Yeah. So we've got a lot of these devices sitting down on the Microsoft stand at the moment. If you want to come on and have an interaction with them, come down and have a play tonight over the next few days. But we've really got some very, very groundbreaking. I mean, look at how thin that is when you go to use it. This is just absolutely beautiful, beautiful pieces of hardware that are coming out on Windows 8. Again, x86 full desktop environment. But apps are key. There's currently an estimated 1.3 billion devices in the Windows ecosystem at the moment. This provides an unprecedented opportunity for developers to build apps for the Windows Store. We can develop these apps for the very, very small screens, and we can develop these apps for the very, very, very big screens. Now, I've been waiting to do this part all day, actually. So we're lucky, and I have to thank the office division that have actually brought this device down. We've managed to get something that not many other countries in the world have seen, and this is something that Steve Ballmer actually has in his office that he uses.
And to be clear, I will be stealing this device as well.
So we want to show you a perceptive pixel device. So what we have in front of us right now is the world's largest touchscreen. 82 inches, 100 points of touch on this device. It's a full Windows 8 environment. You can sit there and move in and out, and it's full touch enabled. And of course, this just looks amazing running a lot of the applications that we've got available right now. So the New Zealand Herald app is an amazing app to actually go. If you've been playing out with the release preview of Windows 8, you'd seen the beautiful user interface. But look, the size of the screen is, I'm 6'4", so it gives you an idea of how big this thing is. But look at how beautiful this just renders and tied with the application. You get the full pinch zoom. You can pull it across. Now, Paul, you were traveling recently. I think you went to France.
Yep.
So suddenly, you get the amazing look and feel of actually how the application works. Now, you are going to be able to have a go of this. This is, again, it's going to be on the Microsoft stand. You can come down later tonight. It'll be for the next 3 days. So I encourage you to come along. Also, doing a link video call on this is absolutely stunning. Absolutely stunning.
1 inch equals 1 inch.
Yeah, exactly. So, but we're going to have a look at some of the office products as well.
This is so big, I have to handle the right and he handles the left.
Yeah, left and right brain.
So this is OneNote MX, as we now call it. This is a Windows 8 style app. This will be part of the coming new version of Office. They've created a couple of different apps that run in this new environment. This is your basic note-taking application. I should be using touch here. So you can take a picture, you can move it around. With touch, you can resize it to something humongous, a huge bowl of soup. You can work with text as well.
If you want to edit text, you just move your finger, drag, oops, from there. And then you get this radial menu that comes out. So it's all touch-based. Now, Paul, let's make the font 72 because I'm a bit blind.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. There we go, beautiful. Suddenly, let's make it purple.
Just for the record, he's changed the color every single time we've done this.
Again, all touch-based, all enabled. But again, you still want to be able to use a stylus when you come out sometimes. You want to be able to write. So, of course, in OneNote, you have the ability to do that. So let's say Brad. Now we can draw an arrow up there. Paul, what do you think about that bowl of soup? Nice. So you get the best of both worlds with the new Office that's coming out. Touch-based, but also the ability to use keyboard or a stylus as well. But we also have some more announcements that we're going to do. I'm pleased to announce for the first time the new Sky TV app, which we'll be releasing with the launch of Windows 8. Sky TV have been working heavily with a key partner to actually develop this app, and this is one of my favorite apps at the moment. I love my sport, but I love to personalize what I do. But before we do that, if you look at this guide, you can actually sit there, and you're getting all this rich information that's coming through. You have the ability to come on and share just like you do with any other ones. But what I like to be able to do is, in a guide sometimes, I don't want to scroll through the Living Channel and E Channel and everything else. I want to get straight to the sports because that's what of interest to me. So let's just take the app, and I can move the guide around. And then when I go to favorites, it's a personalized interface, touch-based, that is personalized just for what I want to do. But let's look. Now, I've been trying to teach you about rugby for the last few days. Yes, interesting.
Last
so let's find out when a rugby game is on, Paul.
All right.
So this is going out in real time, searching what's happening in the guide. Now, we all know the All Blacks are playing Argentina this coming Saturday, so I'm actually going to sit down there. I'm going to record. We're going to yes, and this is going to go onto Nigel's MySky. So now I'm suddenly recording on Nigel's MySky for him this weekend. He's going to actually have a full interface of actually what's going on around the Argentina game. But it's not all just about the applications that we've seen here. We've got some amazing games actually that are going out. And this is where you watch two grown men do big, big games. Yes. So let's do Fruit Ninja. Again, you want to see one of the biggest games. And again, all the touch is coming through. This is 2 millimeter thick Gorilla Glass, one of the biggest pieces of Gorilla Glass that they can make. Yeah, Paul, you're not good at that one.
Yeah.
And we've also got a new game that's coming out, which is going to be developed by a New Zealand firm. It'll be coming out of the release of Windows 8. Do you want us to launch the Frog game? So Ancient Frog will be coming out at the release. Oh, people have been playing this. And this is, again, a very rich interface. Now, Nigel is trying to teach me this. There we go.
Be sure you do check this out, by the way, especially if you're in the back of the room. You can't appreciate how awesome this thing is until you touch it.
Yeah. So it's a really, really amazing experience and it's interaction with what's going on. But let's have a look at some of the amazing other apps that are coming out from New Zealand developers.
We're the first, I believe, the first company in the world 100% focused on designing and developing apps for Windows. So we've taken a real specialized approach, delivering world-class applications for Windows. That's what we do. The potential for Windows 8 is enormous. And I think with Windows 8 in particular, there are some very specific things, such as live tiles, that are unique to that platform. Both on phone and on Windows, the numbers and the install base are huge. And when the platform launches, the numbers are going to grow exponentially. I think developers really need to think about Windows because of the potential of the platform, the numbers of people that are going to be using Windows 8 devices and Windows Phone 8 devices over the coming months and years. The opportunity is probably one of the greatest developer opportunities there has ever been in software. We're working with New Zealand Herald, Trade Me, Air New Zealand, Yellow New Zealand, 7 Digital, and a bunch of other clients we can't talk about right now. We use the whole Visual Studio Team Foundation server set up, including Visual Studio 2012. And Windows 8 apps have been a pleasure to develop in.
We started working with Sky in late 2010. And the first product we worked on with them is the Sky iPhone app. When we started building Sky app for Windows 8, we really went back to the drawing board a lot because we never actually designed the Sky app for a tablet first. One of the things we were able to do with Windows 8 that we've never really done to the extent we've done it before is include a sort of system-wide search function so you can search to find a TV show from pretty much anywhere within Windows.
The first app we released was a YouTube app. The first version that we released only took us about a week. And we sort of put it out in the marketplace, but the key thing is we were the only YouTube app on the marketplace, and this eventually led to MetroTube, which is now the highest rated and most downloaded third-party YouTube app on the platform, and it's currently in the top 1% out of all apps on the marketplace. With our Twitter app, we've already exceeded 100,000 downloads with our Twitter app, and Windows 8 hasn't even launched yet. You know, when this goes live, we could potentially be getting into the millions. Mike and I, we're just two guys, you know, we're a startup, small startup, and we're hitting it we're building apps that, you know, Google could build. Just look at the people who jumped onto the iOS very early on. Look at the people who jumped onto Android early on. These particular opportunities do not come about often. It's not something that come every year or, you know, a new, entirely new platform, an entirely new marketplace with this many users is extremely exciting. To me, I see this as probably the biggest opportunity since the first launch of the smartphones. Now, with Windows 8, it's both. It's a tablet and a desktop environment, and the opportunities are huge.
Our story really starts with transferring our web design skills into the app space. The demand for Windows 8 apps is taking us by surprise. We're talking to companies. We are a little bit surprised that we're talking to at the moment. Obviously, I can't divulge all the details, but we're currently working with ESPN to develop a ESPN Crick Info Windows 8 app. which has just been released to the store. So touch devices have really changed the way that people interact with devices, and I think Windows 8 is a massive step forward in that space. So as cricket fans, we thought really hard about how to use the tablet as a second screen while people are watching cricket on TV. The look and feel of the article pages on CricInfo feel like a magazine. It feels like you're reading a physical magazine. It was all about the little transitions, animations, the orientation changes. Especially reading articles is where we spend a lot of our time just polishing the design. We wanted to build something that us as cricket fans really wanted to use, but we also felt the weight of responsibility to get it right for everyone out there.
Windows Phone. This is actually Bradley's Windows Phone. His wife's been calling him all day, so if that happens during this demo, I apologize. But one of the interesting things you can do with Windows Phone 7.5, which is the most recent version, is that you can buy movies and TV shows online. You can download them to your PC. You can sync them to the phone. You can watch them on the go. And I think we all understand how that kind of thing works. But you can take it a step further with Windows Phone by using the Xbox Companion app. This is an app that allows you to control the Xbox console. You see the screen that's over there. And so from this app, I can control the playback of content from the marketplace. I can press play, and the movie begins playing.
Here, Pilgrim.
Press pause, and the movie pauses, of course. You fast forward and rewind and do all of the expected navigation that you would expect. Xbox Companion is very interesting. It will be succeeded by a new app called Xbox Smart Glass. We'll have more capabilities. And things get further interesting when you bring a tablet into the mix.
That's right. So what I've got here is a Samsung tablet, and I've got Smart Glass installed on this. So as you can see in front of me right now, I have the John Carter movie that Paul was talking about. But what I want to do is I actually want to take that movie. I'm going to pull it, and it's going to transfer through the cloud and start playing on here exactly where Paul left it off. So right in front of me right now is the movie as it plays, which is great. I can go out on the road. I can watch a little bit of the movie. But let's just say I get home, and I want to throw it back up onto the big screen. So let's fast forward it a little bit. So we're here. I'm going to sit there. I'm just going to throw it back up onto the Xbox now. Now, two things are really, really amazing. One it just picked it up in the cloud, seamlessly transferred it across and from that side. But on my actual device here with Smart Glass, it's actually bringing back all the metadata about the movie. So in front of me right now, I have the actors, the cast, and everything else. And in the future, if you will, imagine what you could do with movie or TV shows like Game of Thrones. Very complex television show. Imagine being able to bring up the map of what's actually happening in the environment. Or if you have an actor come onto a stage and in real time it's telling you on your slate who that actor is, what's going on. Now what Paul and I have just demoed in front of you is actually all available right now in New Zealand. You can download the Smart Glass app from the Windows Store and you can actually move the files around and you actually get that rich experience of what's actually happening. So I hope you've had a glimpse of what's coming. We've got a lot of amazing technology that's on the stage here, and we've got a lot more on the Microsoft stand down below. We are really, really, really proud of what we've got coming up. And let's roll the video and see what's coming next.
Xbox Smart Glass transforms the devices you already own and love, your Windows and Windows phones, your iPhone and iPad, and your Android devices. As you can see, my phone and tablet are keeping up with all of the action on TV. My smart device truly takes on the role of an intelligent companion that pulls me deeper into the experience. Glass works with all the devices that you already own. The TV you already own, the phone you already own, and the tablet you already own. Xbox Smart Glass truly turns any TV into a smart TV.
All right, put your hands together for Paul and Brad. Very cool. The ancient frog. It's the sort of thing I'd never seen it before, and it didn't look like much then, but I just know that it's the sort of thing that's going to keep me awake at night for months and months in my future. It's cool. Wow, it's going to be a really exciting week, these announcements. And I hope, by the way, we've also got New Zealand Fashion Week on in Auckland. Is anyone double booked for both events? Looking around, I'm guessing it's not too much of a problem. We've sort of gone for a bit of a Fashion Week theme here. We've had the flashing lights and the catwalk, and no one on stage has eaten since last Thursday. So we're committed to going in theme today. A bit more about my hometown. Does anyone know where internet began in New Zealand? Does anyone know where the original gateway was? Waikato University, very good. So the internet was invented by Hamilton. The first, well, maybe not, but the first email in New Zealand history was sent in 1989 from a computer lab in Waikato to a computer lab in Berkeley University, California. And it read, "What are you wearing, lol?" Which, lol back in those days stood for lots of lab coats, so inadvertently they'd answer their own question. But it took off very quickly, as you all know, and a lot of Hamiltonians have become early adopters as a result. We got the World Wide Web before anyone else in Hamilton, 1992 I think that was. World Wide Web, or as we abbreviated it in Hamilton, W Wide Web. Calling it WWW seems obvious now, doesn't it? But it took about 10 years in Hamilton, as I recall, before someone suggested it for the first time in the W Wide Web abbreviation suggestion news group. It's all right. It's funny. When a joke doesn't work in front of 1,500 people, it sounds the same as when it doesn't work in front of 50 people. It's an amazing thing. We're early adopters. I was the first of my friends onto MySpace, first of my friends onto Facebook, first of my friends onto Bebo. I was the only one of my friends onto Bebo, owing to the fact that I'm not friends with many 11-year-old girls, but you take my point. First onto Twitter. Recently, this year, in April, New Zealand Herald voted me the 37th best Twitterer in New Zealand. Yeah. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Can't help getting a bit competitive, though. Do you know who number 36 was? Philip Duncan from Weatherwatch. Do you know how hard I work on my tweets? This guy looks out the window. It's like giving a journalism prize to the guy who compiles the TV listings in the newspaper. It's disgraceful. Anyway, I've got a blog. Yeah. They don't give a blog to just anyone. You need an email address and a password. And our next speaker has a blog as well, possibly even more read than my one. He's an incredible man, really. His job title is Data Artist in Residence at the New York Times. It's it's a simple, elegant title for what I know is a complex and complicated job. And although he does complex and complicated things in his life, I've seen him speak, and you'll be pleased to know that he speaks about it in a very elegant and straightforward way. And I'm delighted to welcome him to the stage. Please put your hands together for Jura Thorpe.
Thanks, Jeffy. Hello. It's really exciting for me to be here in New Zealand. Paul doesn't understand the competition with Australia. Paul's American. I'm Canadian. being here in Auckland is in particular really interesting for me. I'm from Vancouver, which feels like the two cities were separated at birth. I feel very comfortable here. I was pleased when Nigel picked me up at the airport to learn that we also share the same traditional wintertime greeting, which is, you should have been here last week. The weather was great. But I'm going to be here for a few days, and I couldn't be happier to be here with everybody today. My name is Jer. That's short for Jeremy. I hear all kinds of scattered pronunciations of my name, but you can just call me whatever you'd like. I have a lot of really interesting things to talk about today, but you know, I think a lot of them are kind of standard keynote stuff. I'm going to talk about space. I'm going to talk about the H1N1 virus. I'm going to talk about rabbis on Twitter. I'm going to talk about the fall of communism. And of course, what would a keynote speech be without Tom Cruise? But really, maybe more exciting to all of you, I'm going to be talking about data. And you know, data has really become the substrate of business, but maybe more exciting to me, data has become part of our everyday lives. And for all of you in this room, that maybe seem strikingly obvious, but for everybody else, this is becoming a much more important part of our lives. And what I want to talk to you about today is some of the work that I've been doing over the last couple of years to explore the changing role of data in our everyday lives. Let's start with a little bit of history. It seems like everybody has been talking about history in their talks today. As a young person, I sort of bonded with technology. And like many young people who bonded with technology, I was socially very popular child. I was a hit with the ladies. This is my first computer. And it's beige, yes! Everybody likes beige. And your first computer may have looked like this or may have looked like this, but in the era that I grew up in was really an incredible transformation. I literally had a day, let's call it a Tuesday, where I didn't have a computer, and then on a Wednesday, I had a computer. Right? And many of you had the same experience, maybe at around the same time as in your lives. It was like the Hogwarts train arrived for all of us all at the same time and took us into this new world where we could really explore into infinity with these machines. The guy on the right is maybe the single most influential person on my life, aside from my parents and my girlfriend and all those other people that I see on an everyday basis. This is Bill Atkinson, and Bill Atkinson wrote this program called HyperCard. HyperCard was a program for people to make programs on their computers. So people would make things like an app that would take care of or would track their basketball scores for their local basketball team or would track the research that they were doing at university or maybe would teach people about classical music or convert strange astronomical dates from one format to another. And then my favorite, this one, it's called If Monks Had Macs. It was a game that I spent many hours playing. Was this kind of really weird non-linear game where you could explore this strange monastery and learn all kinds of bizarre facts about different things. But for me, HyperCard was such a launching pad because I really did always think about the computer as something that I could use to make my own tools, that I could use to make my own things that didn't necessarily have to have a business plan attached to them. Right? I could spend an afternoon in my basement and I could make a program and I could do something that I found interesting and exciting. And so I carried this into my career as a software artist. And so some of my early explorations with software as an art form were very formal. So these are trees that are made from an algorithm called L-systems, which are used to simulate plant growth. And these were printed as very large, six-foot tall canvases. But as I got further into my explorations of software and art, I became more interested in the processes themselves than I was necessarily in the result. This is one of my favorite projects. It's called the Color Economy. And there are thousands of small pixels here which are trading color. They're trading red, green, and blue. And I used this as a way to sort of understand some economic theory. I set up this simulation where these particles could trade with one another, hoping to get more color, to get richer. Unfortunately, I couldn't figure out a way of setting up this system in which it didn't end up with one or two very rich particles and a few thousand dead ones. So I'm still working on that. But that project was interesting because it didn't run very well just with the information that I had on the computer, and it didn't run very well with random numbers. So what I started to do is I started to bring in data, and this was my first taste of this world of data. And coincidentally enough, the first data that I looked at was the New York Times. So what you're seeing on the screen here is a graph. It starts in about 1980 and it ends in 2009. And on the bottom, you're seeing the frequency of occurrence of the word communism. And the top, the frequency of occurrence of the word terrorism. So we can see a really, really big societal shift in this graph. Here's a similar graph, but this one reads like a timepiece. So it starts at the top of the clock at 1980 and goes all the way around the clock to 2009. And what we're seeing here are the frequency of mentions of Iran in red and Iraq in black. So these graphs are a way of pulling out a lot of this societal infrastructure that's inside of the database that the New York Times has. Here's another last one that I'll show you from this series. This is hope in white and crisis in gray. So there are only three times that crisis has eclipsed hope, and we are in the middle of one of them right now. I became really interested in the news as data, and I pursued this idea of could we take the entirety of a year's news cycle and capture it in one single graphic? And that led me to this project, which is a series, and they're called This Was 1984 or This Was 1985. And what we see is we see an entire year's most popular figures and organizations in the news. The most popular, 40 of them are around the inside and another about 1,500 around the outside. Now, my intent with these graphics was not to clarify the news, but instead to sort of show the chaotic networks that were present inside of these systems. But again, I got bored with these static graphics, and I became more interested in the systems that were being used to build them. So here's a project that I made called Just Landed. And Just Landed takes advantage of these tweets that we get on Twitter, which I call vanity tweets. So here's a couple of vanity tweets. A very casual tone to them, right? They're talking about landing in Auckland, but really they're show-off tweets, right? They're like, I'm in Auckland and you're not, essentially. And I thought, what if we could take this huge base of vanity and make it into something useful? And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a bioinformatician. She studies specifically epidemiology, how disease spreads. And one of the things that epidemiologists have a hard time with is modeling human travel. So I thought maybe we could take these vanity tweets, we could find out where that person was from, we know they're landing in Auckland, and we could plot their travel. So in 2009, I built this tool called Just Landed, which lets you look at, in this case, we're looking at 36 hours of people traveling just from their vanity tweets. So we're able to pull out something here which was not consciously being revealed. These people were not trying to share their travel plans, but they inadvertently were doing so. Here's the follow-up project called Good Morning. And Good Morning looks at everybody around the world saying good morning to each other on Twitter. The people who show up as green dots are waking up early, and the people with the red dots are waking up late. So there's the West Coast, very red in America, and the East Coast, very green. This was in 2009. I was surprised to find out that there were only 8 good morning tweets from Auckland in 2009. I'm hoping that maybe one of you is here. Is anybody here? Oh, good. I was going to buy each of you a beer, so that's 8 beers I don't need to buy. So these projects that I'm making are really combining some design, some science, some artwork. And what they are is that they're visual tools to understand systems. And I became very interested in these systems that underlie the surface ones. So we know what's happening on Twitter. We can see lots of apps that visualize the actual activity on Twitter. But what can we visualize that we maybe can't see on the surface? And these invisible systems are the things that I'm most focused on. I worked for a while as a contributing editor for Wired magazine, and I had a chance to work with this guy. He's one of the world's most important scientists. His name is Laszlo Barabasi. He studies networks. And we worked with this really big data set of cell phone data from an unnamed European country. It has a name I'm not allowed to tell you. What we were able to do is we were able to look at everybody's cell phone activity over a period of months. So this is a terrible graph. But it's kind of interesting. The people on that person on the left, that spike, that's somebody who talks 84 hours on the phone every week. And that person on the far right-hand side is somebody who does nothing but texting. And I explored these systems a little bit, but nothing was coming out of them. And one of the things I think about when I'm working on my work that's going to end up in public is something that I call the ooh-ah principle. And with the ooh-ah principle, I want to present something that makes people go, ooh. And then I want to present something that makes people go, ah. So I decided that these graphs that I were working on were going to be no good for the ah, but maybe they would be good for the ooh. So I stitched them together, these built together into a 3D system in which every single data point in our data set was rendered on the page. And I can zoom in here, and you can see a little bit of the detail of the graphic. So that was the ooh side on the right-hand side of the spread, but it's really the ah side that I like from this project, where we built these mobility maps. One of the things that we had for a small subset of the people of this data was their location. So this is a person who, over the course of 81 hours, travels only 2.1 kilometers between two places. This is a very dedicated person who is at home and work and home and work and home and work. Right, this person, on the other hand, is traveling, and again, in a very small radius, but they're traveling from one place to another. So I think this person might be a stay-at-home parent who visits the same types of places every day. And actually, we were able to look at these mobility maps for every single person in this database. And we could look at exactly where they'd been during this month that we had to study them. And when I was working on this project, I thought in the beginning that this reminded me of something that I couldn't quite place. And I thought that what it reminded me of was that scene in The Matrix where they're reading the numbers are coming down, and they're saying, oh, I can see who that person is, and so on and so on. But I realized actually it reminded me of something different. It reminded me of this passage from Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon. So I'm just going to give you a second to read that. I'm kidding, I'm not. I'm going to do what everyone should be able to do with Neal Stephenson. I'm going to edit him down. This is a thought experiment, and the thought experiment goes like this. If we were able to tie a light bulb to the head of somebody who was walking through the streets of London, we might get a line that looks something like this. As they're walking on the sidewalk, when they walk onto the road, it goes down, and when they come back up the road, it goes up, and so on and so on. Now, what if we were able to take these lines and gather thousands of them, and thousands of them, and hundreds of thousands of them? We would have these straight lines, which taught us nothing about the way that the roads curved, that taught us really nothing about that other than the single path of a person. But the idea here, and this is the center of the thought experiment, is that if you were to give these lines to some clever people, they would be able to reassemble the map of London. And really, I think that's what's happening in the big data space. We're trying to figure out how we can take large amounts of data and come up with a vision of things that we may not have been able to see before. And so that's what we've been doing at the Times for the last 2 years on this project that I've been working on there. I'm working on this project really closely with Mark Hansen. He's a professor of statistics now at Columbia University. And the project is called Cascade. And what Cascade does is it tries to answer a very simple question. How does content on the internet get from person A to person B? Or in the case of a broadcast medium like Twitter, how does it get from person A to person B to person C, D, and E? Well, this may seem like a very simple question, but in fact, it's something that we don't really know very much about. We call these event chains, we call these cascades. So here's a very simple cascade. What we're doing with this tool is we're positioning those events in time. Now, that's a very boring cascade, a very simple one. Let's look at what a sample cascade actually looks like. Here's a cascade. One cascade, these are all events that led from a single person's tweet. So on the bottom left-hand side, we have a single person tweeting. And on the far right-hand side, 28 hours later, we have some other people tweeting. Every pink dot you see is a tweet. Every yellow dot that you see is somebody coming back to read that story on our website. And we can view this in a couple of different ways. This one we call radar view, which allows us to separate the threads of conversation. And then finally, we have this view called tree view, which allows us to do all three of these things. So still images don't do this project any justice. And we'll see a video in a second. Now, the Times produces 6,500 pieces of content every month. And we're lucky enough that people talk about our content. So what we need to do is we need to find a way to dig through this huge, huge pile of data and come up with the interesting things. So one thing that I advocate in as far as data visualization is concerned is building exploratory tools. I always think that most of the visualizations that you see produced are like a photograph of the Grand Canyon. It's very beautiful, but it really doesn't give you a feeling of what that space actually looks like. With an exploratory tool, we can park somebody in a Jeep and drive them to the Grand Canyon and say, hey, here's the Grand Canyon. Why don't you find out what you like about this place? So here's a cascade from a story called But Will It Make You Happy? This is kind of an interesting story. It was published about a year and a half ago. It's about people who have reduced their possessions to 50. That includes knives and forks and socks and stuff. Can you imagine that, reducing your possessions to 50? So here we are 20 hours into this cascade, the kind of normal conversation around this, the kind of thing that we would be expecting to see. And then, right at around 24 hours, keep your eye on that graph at the top right, we're going to see a spike right here. Now, what was that spike? Well, we can unpack this system and we can walk through it. So in this case, this original tweet came from this guy named Valdis Krebs. He's a Latvian network scientist. And Valdis Krebs followed this person who 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 was followed by Zappos. And here's Zappos.com tweeting a link to our story about people who reduce their possessions to 50. Now, what this told me was two things. First of all, we don't really understand Twitter very well. We don't really understand what helps drive people to specific pieces of content. But the tool allows us to unpack that chain. It allows us to see what's happening. And we can do this with all 6,500 pieces of content. This system runs live. It runs in the browser. So we can have everybody on in our company who wants to be using this tool using it in real time. But really, it's not the big story that's really important. It's the small ones that really interest me. This is my favorite cascade. I call it the rabbi cascade. And I call it the rabbi cascade because it's entirely rabbis. And they're talking about this story that we published in the Times. And this caught my eye because of one of these rabbis has the best Twitter name ever. He's called the Velveteen Rabbi. And this was really endearing to me because it captured something that was, I think, or is, I think, integral to the Times data, the New York Times data. There's a certain character in the types of discussions that our readers are having. And this tool not only allows us to see these events, which we call lightning strike events, but it also allows us to see these much smaller things, which underlie those lightning strike events. And it gives us also a look into this idea, which is really central to the way that I think about all these projects, is that data has character. Right? It's not just a set of numbers in a spreadsheet. Every set of data has a different character. So let's switch gears a little bit. I was in Austria 2 months ago, and while I was working on this project that I'm going to show you, and I walked down this small alleyway in the town that I was in, Graz, and I came upon this plaque, which I'll give you a minute to read. I won't. I'll translate it. I'm not going to read it, but this is a plaque for Johannes Kepler. And basically what the plaque said is that this gentleman lived in Graz for 10 years while he worked on this project. He wrote this book called Mysterium Cosmographicum, I think I'm pronouncing that right, in which he tried to answer the biggest problem of the day, which is how can we predict the orbits of the planets? And over about 10 years, he came up with this theory that maybe the orbits of the planets can be described by tying them to the Platonic solids, to these sort of geometric constants. And he worked on this idea for 10 years, and he was very convinced of it. It was completely wrong. And unlike, I think, what I would have done, he didn't pack it up. Instead, he changed his ideas and really reinvented astronomy. And here we are, a couple of hundred years later, and I'm going to show you some science which has come out over the last few months, which bears his name, which I think is really exciting. Some of you probably know about it already, but hopefully we'll glean a little bit of insight into it. Can I get these lights out too? Yes, it's space. It must be dramatic. This is Cygnus Lyrae. It occupies a point in space about the size of your outstretched hand. And for the last few years, the Kepler satellite has been focusing on this region of space with 21 photoreceptors. These 21 photoreceptors don't move. They're positioned on this exact point in space. And if we zoom into these photosensors, you'll get an idea of what these scientists are looking at or looking for. They're looking for these tiny dots of light, which are distant stars. And specifically what they're looking for is they're looking for those lights to dim and then to brighten again. Right? Light bulbs on top of somebody's head. From those lights dimming and brightening, they can come up with these graphs. And when they see a graph like this one with these periodic dimmings in light, they know that they found a planet, or they can guess that they found a planet orbiting around that distant star. And using Pleiades, which is the world's seventh largest supercomputer, they can crunch through this data, and they can discover a huge amount of these new planets. They've discovered 2,326 new planets. One of the greatest scientific achievements of the last decade, for sure. And to celebrate this achievement, they published a paper. And that paper, just to capture the grandeur of the science, they published these gorgeous graphs and charts, which just when you show these to children, they get excited about science. And they think, Dad, when I grow up, I want to be one of these people who work at NASA. Actually, to scientists, this is very exciting, but to us, it isn't. And when I read this paper, I was disappointed because I was very excited in the science. So what I did is I decided to rebuild these graphics. I decided to take a look at them in a different way. So over the course of about a day and a half, I built this little tool which allows me to go through and look at the same data in what I think is a little bit more of a natural and maybe a little bit more of an exciting way. So here are all 2,326 of these planets as if they were orbiting around a single star. And we can do some things with them. I'm going to sort them in a second by temperature. We'll put the hot ones up and the cool ones down. And in case you're dying for a graph, we can put it into a graph form. And then I'm going to sort this graph. We're going to sort it and put the larger ones up, and so you can sort of see the size of these planets. So actually, within a few hours, as I was working on this, I got to the meat of the science. And the meat of the science so far is this. The planets that they've discovered are quite large, they're quite hot, and they're very close to their suns. As we pan out here, that middle line is half of Earth's orbit. The slightly darker line is a full-size Earth's orbit. And as we come all the way out, that's Jupiter's orbit. So you can really get an idea of the types of planets that are being discovered so early on into this project. And I'm really excited about this idea of building these, I call them bespoke tools, to explore a specific type of data. There's something really great about a tool that can show any type of data. But often, those types of tools really miss out on this thing what we were talking about before, which is the character of data. Now, I got an opportunity about 4 months ago to take this one step further. Whenever I'm working on these projects, I always feel like I want to take them off the screen in some way. And this one, remember, this is so exciting. By the way, there's 48 of these planets which occupy what they call the magic zone. These are possibly habitable planets, planets that we could find life on. And this is, again, the most exciting possible science as far as I'm concerned. So whenever I'm working on these things, inevitably somebody over my shoulder says, wouldn't that be cool if we could do the Minority Report thing with that? And for years I would say, like, shut up. And then I met this guy, John Unterkoffler, who designed all the systems for the Minority Report. And he has a company called Oblong in California. And I got a chance to come for 2 weeks and be the artist in residence at Oblong. And we developed this thing. So this is the same system you saw before, but using these kind of spatial gestural systems. And I know that we're seeing a lot of great gestural technology this week, and we're seeing lots of touch-based technology. And for me as a data person, I get really excited about that because it allows us to do something which I've always wanted to do with data, and that is to get rid of the interface. I want no interface in my exploratory tools. Instead, what I want is I want the data to be the interface. So for the first time with this project, I got the idea of what this might feel like, what it might feel like to use the data as interface. So we built this system which can run on any set of screens that allows us to fly through this whole Kepler environment. We can use a set of gestures that we wrote custom for this system to run through the same type of sorting methods that we saw before. And I really think that technology like this giant screen that we see over here is really going to change the way that we interact with data, because we are able to do things like we're doing here, which is putting 2,300 objects onto a screen and still have them usable. And on a normal computer screen, that really wouldn't be possible. Thank you. Let's leave space and let's come back to Earth. And I always find this transition in any talk that I give very difficult. So I live in New York City, and in New York City, any day, anytime you have a day that looks like this with a bright blue sky, you start to hear stories from people. I was not in New York City during 9/11, but lots of my friends who live in New York City were, and all of them have a story. You know, all of us around the world have a story as well of where we were when we heard about it, and so on. My own 9/11 story was relatively unexciting. I walked into my office in Vancouver. I saw the towers falling on television. I had the reaction that everybody has, that they thought they were watching a movie, and the same reaction that I think a lot of people in other countries had. But since then, my relationship with the event has really changed, because in 2009, I was asked to work on an algorithm that would help the architects place the nearly 3,000 names that are on the 9/11 memorial in Manhattan. The architects had this really great idea for the names. They wanted the names not to appear in alphabetical order, not to appear in any other type of sorting order, but instead to feel as if they were all together. But within that, they wanted to build what they called meaningful adjacencies. They wanted to have the ability to have people who had relationships within their lives to be together, to be next to each other on the memorial. So the most simple way to think of that is that brothers or sisters or mothers and fathers would be together on the memorial. But of course, these were office towers. People spent their entire lives in these towers, or a lot of their lives in these towers, and these relationships were manifold. There were thousands of them. In fact, there were 2,900 names, and within those names, there were about 1,400 of these adjacency requests. And so this was a great idea that the architects had, but in fact, a quite difficult one to achieve. And so the first thing that I did when I was given this problem is, I said, I'm not sure that this could be done. The second thing I did is that I built a visualization. Sometimes it's easy for us to forget that visualization is not an end result. It's not a noun. You don't make a visualization. Visualization is a process. It's something we do to help us understand a problem. And so the first thing I did was build a visualization. So these are the two towers and all of the names that would be put around them. And the lines that you're seeing are these requested adjacencies. So actually, the large part of the problem and the part that we were brought in to solve was this problem down on the far left-hand side, where we had a huge amount of interrelated names. So we were given the task of solving this problem. This is Jake Barton from Local Projects, who I collaborated with this on this project. And we built a software tool. So the two things we built was we built an algorithm to lay out the names, and we built out a software tool to allow the architects to then adjust that layout as they needed. Architects are very exacting people. So we were given the benchmark to satisfy 95% of the requested adjacencies. We ended up solving 100% of the adjacencies. And we also built this system, which I really believe is really important. And because a lot of people, when I talk about this project, they say, oh, you've used a computer to solve this problem. But we didn't, actually. We used a computer to assist humans who solved this problem. You know, this is a deeply human task, building a memorial. And the computer acted as a tool, not as some type of mindless robotic device that was able to go through and do something better than humans couldn't do. I love this picture. It gives you a sense of what the memorial feels like. It's a very a tactile experience, and definitely seeing people approach the memorial and seeing their family members with the people who are meaningful in their lives was a really moving moment for me. I think the memorial, though, it's interesting to think about it in a greater societal terms. What we're showing here in a public memorial is we're showing the social networks that these people had within their lives. In a way, what we're doing is we're sort of making those networks permanent, these things that people have built up over their lives, right? There are narratives, there are stories built into this memorial. And that's really the big thing that I want to talk to you about today. Remember this quote from that Neal Stephenson story. One day this person would walk out of that room carrying a highly accurate street map of London, reconstructed from the information in all those square wave plots. So what these people are doing, they're doing something that has a name. It's called opportunistic sensing. They're using all of their light bulb people as sensors, and then they're coming up with a result. And this is how 99% of work with big data happens today. Opportunistic, meaning that we don't know about it. Right? Opportunism is this conscious policy and practice of taking selfish advantage of circumstances. You can read, so I won't read the rest of it. And I think all of us, as we speak today, are the sometimes unwitting parts of these opportunistic sensing systems. About a year and a half ago, there was a big controversy because it was discovered that the eye devices were storing location data, and that location data was easily accessible to anybody. So there was an outcry about this. There was an outcry because of privacy issues. But I thought to myself, and a group of us at the Times thought to ourselves, this is very useful data. The problem is that the people who could make the best use from it are not necessarily getting it. So we started this project called Open Paths to explore this idea of how people can use their own data and how we can donate data, data philanthropy, how we can put data to use for the common good. So if you go to Open Paths today, you'll find a website that looks something like this. You can use mobile devices of various kinds to record your own location data. It doesn't do anything particularly complicated. But what it does is it puts the data into your hands, and it allows you to explore it. So here is one of my colleagues' map, and we can do some really simple things. We can find out what time of the day you're moving along your path, whether it's day or night, whether it's weekday or weekend. So we lure people in with this really simple visualization. But really what we're doing is we're giving them the experience of something which I believe is really important, and that's the experience of data ownership, of actually owning the data that you're producing. First party access. Nobody ever talks about the first party. We talk about the third party. Lots of you are third parties in this room. We talk about the second party. Some of you are second parties in this room. But the first party is rarely invited to the party. People don't necessarily get their data. They can't use it. And what we want to do is we want to give people this experience of using their own data so that they can build a personal relationship with it. Weirdly enough, lawyers get this. This is a memo that was released by the California District Attorney's Office. And there's this one sentence that I love from this memo, which is that cellular phones have become the virtual biographer of our daily activities. And this is totally true. The cell phone is writing your biography, right? It's writing a story of your life. And we've been exploring some ways that we can represent these types of stories visually. These are some graphics that Brian House at our lab did, exploring what he calls meaningful locations within his map. There's a couple of them. We had a group produce this tool. We have an open source API for Open Paths. So they produced this tool which shows you how far you're traveling and how many kilograms of carbon you're producing. And then I've been exploring these in a more aesthetic and sort of a more artistic sense. These are all of my directional vectors. These are the directions that I'm traveling. And this one reads like a clock as well. So in this case, we can see how my day unfolds and how I'm moving, my patterns of movement over different days. And I love this idea of people being able to record this stuff on their phones and then print out a print and put it on their walls and kind of have this passive experience of interacting with their own data. The other thing that we're doing with this project, which I think is really exciting, is that we're allowing people to voluntarily donate their data to researchers. So we have a page on the site, if you go there, which is called the projects page, and anybody can propose a project. They can go and they can say, hey, I'm a researcher at X and X University. We'd like to use the Open Paths data. An email gets sent out to Open Paths users, and they can voluntarily say yes or no. So this is this data philanthropy aspect of what I was talking about. But really the important thing is to get people thinking about data in a human context. We think about data as numbers. We often think about them in a spreadsheet. What we don't think about really is really what those numbers represent. So here are three location points from my Open Paths database. Right? It's boring stuff. We can see why when people are asked, do you want to share this with another company, you just say, yeah, sure, they're just numbers. They don't necessarily mean anything to me. This first number, it was the moment that I touched down to start my new life in New York City. I lived in Vancouver for 20 years, and I was restarting my life. That night, I had a dinner at this Thai restaurant on Amsterdam Avenue. I had this spicy noodle dish and this really great glass of Riesling. I'd forgotten completely about this until I worked with Open Paths. This is the moment that I met my girlfriend. Right? These are not numbers. These are parts of our lives. And people, I think, don't understand that. And that's one of the most important things that I've been thinking about a lot when we've been thinking about data. Because really, these devices are recording our histories. And how can we preserve those histories? How can we work with those histories in interesting ways? So data in a human context is super important to me. Because I think if we can get people thinking about data within that context, we build in this automatic thing, which I think is missing, which is an empathy for other people who exist within those systems. And from that becomes a fundamental respect, which is, in a large point, missing in a lot of the systems involving data. I was speaking at a conference about a year ago, and somebody proudly announced, data is the new oil, to which there was applause. because oil brings money and money brings things and everyone's happy. But I was so shocked that people would applaud that because we did such a great job with oil. Right? So we have this new resource coming our way, which I think is bound with a similar set of problems, although maybe not in the context that we would normally think about. And I think that it's really important for us to start dialogue about these things. And in my mind, this dialogue needs to come from various sides. And I was really excited to be asked to speak at this event because we have a lot of people in this audience who have a heck of a lot of power, a heck of a lot of technical power and ability, and have the ability to start some of these dialogues about how we can be using data in positive ways. So I just want to end with a little bit of a call, which is to say that all of us have the ability to get into this discussion about data. And I want all of us to think about how we can start a dialogue that doesn't necessarily involve a business plan, doesn't necessarily involve a dollar sign, but maybe involves the greater good and it involves some creative ways that we can use this type of information. So I'm going to be here for the rest of the week, and I tell you the main reason that I come to these conferences is to talk to people. And I would love to talk to all of you. There's 2,000 of you, so I might not have time. But if you do get a chance to come and find me sometime over the next 3 days, I would love to have a conversation. Thank you.
Thank you much, Jared Thorpe. And remember that message of Jer's. If you can remember any of those Twitter names he had up there, he will buy you a beer afterwards. That's a really generous offer from our guest. So, also, did you see the cameo appearance from Green MP Mojo Mathers up on screen as well? That was pretty cool. And a great way to seg into the final part of Keynote. I feel like we haven't used this sofa enough. It's quite hard to sit on a sofa casually in the front of this many people, though, isn't it? No, I'll do it standing up. Good. Well, our next guest is a very important woman. She is the Minister for the Environment. She's Associate Minister for Earthquake Recovery. And most importantly for the people in this room, she's the Minister of Communications and Information Technology. She is very, very excited about the importance of the IT industry to New Zealand. And I'm very delighted to welcome her onto the stage. So please put your hands together for the Honourable Amy Adams and Scott from Microsoft.
Thanks, Jesse. Hey, Amy. It's fantastic that you could join us just briefly at the end here of the keynote. You've seen some amazing stuff we've just had with Jer, and I just wonder, what's the government's view on big data and open data?
Yeah, well, like Jer, we're pretty excited about it, actually, and I'd just say, unlike oil, we don't think we're reaching peak data anytime soon, and we're still producing plenty of it. So we think there's a huge opportunity to much better use the data that government produces. We have screeds of this stuff, and we're really motivated to get it out there into the community so people can use it. We think there's a tremendous opportunity for new business ventures to take it, to harness it, and to turn it into something much more usable.
What kind of data? What kind of examples can you give us?
Oh, look, there's about 2,000 data sets that have been released so far through our data.govt.nz website, bit of a plug for the website. Look, it covers everything from geospatial information, environment data, historical records, archives, electoral results, but it's pretty dry. So really what it needs is someone with a clever idea, a bit of technical know-how to go in and to turn it into something sexy and easy to use.
Okay, so we've got Jer here, but we've also got 2,000 other kind of developers and IT professionals here. So do you think these guys might be able to help us in some way?
Absolutely. I mean, I talk a lot with the IT sector about looking for opportunities for the little guys, the small companies, to find a way to get their names known, to get recognised. I think this is a great resource, and I think one of the big developments we're going to see in the IT sector actually is people taking this data, using it, and turning it into a commercial solution. So I'd certainly like to see more of that in New Zealand.
Okay, well, I think we should take the opportunity right now to announce a competition for the best Windows 8 app that humanises data. This is open data available from the company. So
data.govt.nz
is the place to find out. And we're going to give away 5 incredible, amazing devices of the future around about October 26th or just beyond there, which might be of interest to you. So full details on our website and at the Windows 8 Apps Lounge downstairs. We'd love to see you guys take part in that. So Any closing thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, just I think that's a great idea, and I'm really excited to see what the clever people in this room come up with.
Cool. Well, I hope you come along when we draw the prize and see what we can get from that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amy. Okay. Bye-bye. Okay, so we're almost there, folks. So you've seen a whole lot of stuff today. So I hope that you go away from that feeling a little inspired. You know, in 37 years of Microsoft's history, this is the biggest year ever. There's nothing like it. You know, we've got the tools and platform for you to go out and create things. The developer opportunity that's in front of us today and in front of you is unparalleled. We've never seen it before. So no matter whether you're writing for a phone, for a tablet, for an Xbox, for a PC, for a server, for the cloud, we've got the technology behind that. It's the same developer platform. It's the same technology platform behind it. And it's the same tools. It's Visual Studio 2012. It's everything that you need. So it's a really fantastic time. I hope that when you finish on Friday, you've learned a whole lot and you emerge ready for a whole new world of software, of services, and you know what? There might be some devices too. Thank you.
Sexy beast.